reasons that they can't name. Some carry with them a private intention. Some come along to watch the scenery change.
Like Bobby Roche says, some carry a private intention, some just watch the scenery change. But the thousands of people who walk the pilgrim road to Santiago de Compostela will experience a change in themselves, which might surprise them. Hello, I'm Rachel Kahn. This is The Spirit of Things, and you're on RN Summer. And about to journey on the Camino with my guests Ailsa Piper and Father Tony Doherty.
Something in my life is just...
It's now a World Heritage Site, but the Camino de Santiago de Compostela in Spain is a pilgrimage route that goes back to the 8th century. It's believed that the bones of St. James, one of the 12 apostles, were taken from Jerusalem and reburied in the northwest tip of Spain. It's the third most important Catholic pilgrimage besides to Rome and to Jerusalem, but there are different roads to take from France or through Portugal and a couple through Spain itself. Ailsa Piper, an actress, writer, and theatre director based in Melbourne, has written a book about her trek on the Camino called Sinning Across Spain. Believe me, it's not like it sounds. Leaving her husband at home, she travelled solo, but with a mission. And when Monsignor Tony Doherty of Sydney read her book, it started a dialogue that's still going on about faith and sin and the kindness of strangers. And they're with me today. Ailsa Piper, Father Tony Doherty, it's great to have you on The Spirit of Things.
Thank you, Rachel.
It's lovely to be here.
Well, the Camino, the pilgrimage to St. James, is one of the most trendy spiritual walks these days. It goes alongside, I think, trekking to Nepal is probably the top place to go to have a spiritual experience. And I confess that when I knew that you'd written a book, Ailsa, on the Camino, I thought, oh, not again. You know, what more can be said about this? But I must say, from the first page, I was taken in by the most interesting approach that you took, which was to carry people's sins. Now, how did that come about?
I was researching for an adaptation of the great Webster play, Duchess of Malfi. Chock full of sins, that play. But there are pilgrims who appear in the original, and I didn't really think the pilgrims would be useful to us, so I was researching pilgrimage. And I had already walked the Camino Francés, so I found this odd little piece of information that said that in medieval times, a pilgrim could be paid to carry the sins of another to a holy place, and the person who paid would get absolution, and the other one would take their little blisters home again. And for some reason, that seemed to me immeasurably wonderful as an undertaking to carry somebody else's baggage.
Well, how many sins did you carry? And I imagine there might have been some interesting responses to your request.
Yes, I didn't really know how to go about it. So I put out this quite flippant letter in some ways. I will walk off your sins, pilgrims seek sinners for mutually beneficial arrangement. Truly, when I did it, I was thinking I would write a monologue for a friend of mine to perform in the theatre. I didn't think at all about the consequences, I have to say. I was a genuine fool taking it on. And I sent the letter, and people did send me very quickly extraordinary confessions. People also took on the idea of sin and said why they didn't believe in it. People really engaged with it. What I learned was that it's a word with considerable bite. So I ended up with a swag of about 20-something. I can't quite remember the exact number because there were some that were multiples. But some of them were beyond anything I would ever have imagined, and they frightened me a little because of the responsibility that people gave me.
And how about you? Were you carrying any of your own sins?
The sin I realised I carry every single day of my life, she says through gritted teeth, is pride. And, you know, pride's a really smart-looking sin because what it looks like is, oh, I'm independent and I can do things for myself and I won't bother you. But in fact, it's quite a hard-hearted sin, I learned, because it says, don't come near me, I don't need you, I don't need to soften to another human being. And I had to learn that over and over again, and I continue to have to learn it. I'm not very gracious about receiving But I didn't intend to carry a sin of my own. I was on a mission to carry for other people. But that one caught me almost daily.
Mm. Well, Father Tony, is this practice of carrying someone else's sins and expiating them in any way alive in today's church, or was Ailsa truly reviving an artifact of medieval times?
I couldn't think of many parallels or any parallels. Perhaps I can approach it by saying that, like you, I received Ailsa's book last Easter, Easter before last, 2012. It's a fairly busy time, might I say. And in the post came this book, Sinning Across Spain. I must say it had almost no interest to me. The title didn't sort of appeal. The time was wrong. But I made also the extraordinary mistake of opening the first page. And I read it over Easter. And it expanded my mind about how Ailsa had approached this. To go to your question, is there precedent? Well, not in any formal sense, but I began to become very curious about a woman in this very enlightened age from a theatre, perhaps no previous theological experience. May I say that?
Yes, I mean, I grew up Catholic, but I certainly didn't. I didn't take on theology, that's for sure.
No, but nor dipping your toe into this sort of really controversial area. Mm. That really touched my curiosity. But my first reaction was what medieval superstition that, thank goodness, we have freed ourselves from in this enlightened age. But on second glance, I began to ask myself questions, which I'm still asking.
Well, the idea of literally paying off your sin sounds dangerously close to indulgences, where you paid to be relieved of the punishment for a confessed sin. And hasn't the church gone away from that sort of practice?
I think a lot of the church has gone away from it. There's a very big organization, the Roman Catholic Church. And there are many ideas which float around in it. And I have to say, there are some elements of the church who do see the advantage of talking in terms of somehow making reparation for your delinquencies. And that might be called indulgence. I don't think it would be truthful to say it is no longer part of any part of the Roman Catholic Church. They also seem to be recovering an idea of carrying one another's sins. And also, by the way, as has been said, being paid for it. And so I thought, that's a bit of history that we think we have moved away from. Then I realized that a lot of my work is connecting with people, carrying their loads of all sorts of things, and I'm paid, might I say, modestly, but it leads to a handsome lifestyle.
Well, there is a key element here, Ailsa, that you mentioned, which is confession. I mean, the very act of taking on this burden is also to elicit confessions. And that's something most certainly alive and well, not only in the Catholic Church, but perhaps in all traditions. Mm.
And in other places like Alcoholics Anonymous, those sorts of organisations too. I think the thing that shocked me about it was how prepared people were to tell me profoundly painful things from their lives. And of course, remember, they're coming at me across a desk to an email, you know, so I was reading their actual words, which are in the book, and that was a shock. And also, it was a real wake-up call to me that what I was taking on was not a walk in the park. It made me wonder how on earth I was to do it. Just going back to the payment thing for a moment, which is interesting, my first response to it was, oh, I don't need to be paid for this, and I don't want to be paid for this, I'll find my own way. But because I have a tendency anyway to take on other people's stuff, to try to sort of fix other people's lives, I realised that there's actually good sense in the thing. It doesn't have to be a lot of money. I mean, it could be $5, but there's something about the exchange. So in my mind, what I was doing was I had a job. It was simple. I had work. I had to just walk and take on the sins, think about the sins. So there's something kind of pure in that for me, which is interesting because, of course, it went to pride. I didn't want to ask for payment. But going back to those folk in medieval times, I think they actually knew something. Now, maybe that was the church, but there was something in the notion of exchange, because what happened with me was something quite personal. I mean, I wasn't always looking them in the eye, but I had their words in my inbox, in my hands. And yes, there was something profoundly personal about that. But also they were saying, here, I pay you. Do you take this? And don't stop until you get there.
It's serious. Well, you've mentioned the walk. Let's talk about it. You have done the Camino before, the Française. Mm. How different is the one that you did this time, the Mozarabe?
They're very different. The Camino Francés is a wonderful experience. I always say to people, if they're called to do it, do it. But it's very much about community. I mean, I did find times of solitude because I like solitude, but it's quite difficult to have extended periods of solitude there. You can get by without a lot of Spanish because there are so many English speakers, or the Spanish along the path there speak, you know, some English. The Mozarabe, it starts from Granada and it goes through Cordoba. So it's got all that wonderful Andalusian history, wonderful and bloody history of the Moors and the Christian battles, which was also what drew me to that walk, because I felt that I was walking in a land where the Christian struggle had sort of played out with other religions and the Jews in Cordoba and Andalusia. So it had a profound feeling for me of being in touch with what I call the palimpsest of the land, you know, those layers under my feet. Also, on the Mozarabe, there's no refuges as there are on the Frances. And so you really are thrown into the lives of people who, many of them, don't know that it's a pilgrim route. They will say to you, what are you doing with that pack on? You're a woman on your own, what are you doing? You say, I'm, you know, peregrino. And they would say, no, that happens up there, pointing up to the north. So it's very different, very solitary.
What's the terrain like?
Well, the first 300 kilometres anyway is just olives. Hills, rutted, heavy, clayey, sort of difficult soil. Then you would hit highways and things, because, of course, it's not as travelled as the Camino Francés, and so they're making routes where they can. But it goes through some wonderful villages. The distances are longer. You must be able to walk 25 to 30 kilometres
well,
a day.
It's 1,300 kilometres, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
To Santiago.
To Santiago, or to Finisterre. It's 1,200 to Santiago. But also the distances between the villages on that one are much longer. On the Francés, you can do 12, 15 kilometres and stop. But on the Mozarabe, a lot of the villages, it's 30-odd kilometres
between.
And tell
me, in the morning, when you started, what did you do with the sins that you were carrying and how did they affect you?
Well, I didn't really know how to go about it, so I just decided that I would create a ritual, and I would sit every morning with my breakfast, whatever I had, depending on where I was. And I would read them aloud, because I suppose growing up in the theatre but also believing in ritual, I think putting words into the air is terribly important. And so I would read them. I mean, I actually knew them off by heart by the end. And then I would just walk, and whatever the road threw to me, I would ponder in the light of those. Or if there were people, I would inevitably have to stare down one of the sins, you know, gossip, lying, those sorts of things came up almost every day.
Ailsa Piper carried the sins of others and a few of her own on the Camino de Santiago de Compostela, which prompted serious reflection and some revealing encounters with strangers. Sinning Across Spain is her book and blog, which started a dialogue between her and Father Tony Doherty, the parish priest of Rose Bay and Dover Heights in Sydney. Now all three of us are in a trialogue here on The Spirit of Things. Find us on the RN homepage. Father Tony, you've travelled the Camino as well.
I have.
Which one did you take?
I took the Frances. Mine was a bit of a stroll compared to this valiant walker. But for me it was very significant. But I walked from a place called León to Santiago. A few weeks after, Ailsa, we did not know one another, had no contact, but it was about the same time in 2009, and it was about 350 kilometres. It was an exacting and an exhilarating exercise. One aspect of it which was often asked me was, you know, was it a spiritual experience? Well, yes and no. I mean, I think my first memory of it was concentrating on just moving 1 kilometre at a time. The physical challenge was, yes, it stretched me. I would walk probably about 20 to 25 kilometres a day with a pack and with my friend, a friend I went with. At the end of it, a young woman came to me and said, did you pray on the Camino? And like Ailsa, in the morning, I would go through a little bit of a ritual of the psalms that I would say in my normal priest's prayer. And introduce my friend to that sort of, but perhaps only for 20 minutes. But the rest of the time was, look, I don't want to call it slog, but my body was fully engaged in moving from A to B. And the comment at the end of the day when a young woman said, did you pray? And I described that. She said, you know what, you prayed with your feet. And that actually was a very accurate description of what I think a great substance of the Camino was about.
And you know, praying with my feet was the alternate title for the book.
Ah, well, it might have got Father Tony Doherty in more quickly than
yes.
sinning across Spain had you chosen it. But Ailsa, you met all kinds of people along the way. And I wonder whether, well, you've already alluded that some were unnerving, some were wonderful. Did they arouse sins in you that you didn't know you had?
Yes, all of them. You know, I mean, in a way, the act of being human with another human being is constantly asking you to sin in some ways, it seems to me. Part of the action of walking with them was that I was examining my life in a way that I don't think is maintainable, not to that degree, unless you're living a contemplative life. So every action became an object of such intense scrutiny. At one point, I don't actually use my iPod when I walk, but I had it with me just in case because I was going alone for so long. And I discovered that when I didn't want to engage with people, I could just pop the headphones on and pretend that I was listening to music until one day when I realised that that was lying and acting a lie. And so I had to take it off and say to someone, I want solitude, I don't want to be in your company. Now, that intense scrutiny is sort of ridiculous, I suspect, for our normal life.
We couldn't live without a kind of honesty, could we?
Of course, we can't. But it did affect me, though, because the level of kindness that was thrust at me from all sides, right from the beginning, there were two young men I met on an aeroplane. For 1 hour, I sat beside them. They were a gay couple. They were married, I found out much later, living in Barcelona. And they were horrified to hear of what I was taking on, a woman alone walking across Spain. Are you crazy? And so they insisted that they take my phone number. They rang me every single day for 6 weeks, bearing in mind we'd spent an hour together.
Extraordinary.
And they would say, do you need any money? Do you need us to come? Is there anything difficult that you can't translate? We will, you know, we'll translate it. You just tell us. This every single day. And I couldn't make sense of it. You know, I really couldn't make sense of the level of kindness for no reason. And when I was approaching Santiago, they said to me, you must come to Barcelona. You'll need help at the end of what you've done, because they knew what I was doing each day and how I was. And I said, oh no, they were strangers. My husband actually said to me, they're the only people who've made the journey with you. I think you have to go. So I did this bizarre thing. I went to Barcelona to these strangers and I spent 10 days with them. And you know, that whole thing about pride, I felt the Camino was a masterclass in pride every day, from the little ladies who would come out and stuff food into my pack, from the people who would rub my feet, from the people who would find me somewhere to live for a night, to those extraordinary two men. When I got to Barcelona, I thought I had it licked. I thought, okay, I've learned how to receive. It started again. They gave me tent. They got out of their own bed and they slept on the couch in their house. They had bought clothes for me when I arrived because they knew I would be grubby. It was unbelievable what they did for me. And so I feel like I was torn open in a way by the kindness of people along the road. Only once did I meet someone who I thought was unworthy, who was kind of a sinner. And that was when I was walking with two elderly Italians who were unbelievably kind to me, who could walk magnificently. But
I think the soldat and the soldato il capitano.
And il capitano is currently on the road again. He's amazing. But they taught me to walk in company with a little grace. And I was with them one evening and this German gentleman said to me, because a woman alone too on that road is very unusual, and he was kind of wanting to chat. And he said, why do you walk with these old men? And I said, they're my friends. And he said, do you let them pay for you? And I said, I don't understand the question. And he said, well, are they paying for your lodgings and your food? And I said, no, no. And he said, well, you should take what you can get. You know, you're an attractive woman and you should take what you can get. And I remember being so shocked at that, because it was the first time I'd met anything that seemed like unkindness, and particularly because it was about these exceptionally open-hearted friends. And all the next day I wanted to see him and say to him, how dare you? And my soldato, I told him in the end, because he knew something was wrong. And he picked up a stick and he said, if I meet him, I will take him on for making you cry.
Well, you learned not to act on that desire for vengeance.
Yes.
Father Tony, I'm wondering about that experience of those two men who showed such extraordinary kindness to Elsa. And I wonder whether it's something about the Camino. I mean, if Elsa was just on a holiday in Spain, would it necessarily elicit such kindness, such generosity from two strangers?
It's a question I've asked myself too. Somehow, some of the best experiences that I have had, perhaps wider than the Camino, is with strangers. Some of the most generous, open-hearted gestures have come to me from people I've had no background with. I don't know the answer to this question, but there's something about a freedom with a new friend or someone that you meet on the way. Now, that's certainly multiplied on the Camino because that really is the juice of it. I mean, you're meeting people all the time. You're sharing stories. But there's something about the freedom of being outside your own normal situation that either attracts or leaves you open to quite extraordinary experiences. It has happened to me on holidays, by the way. I mean, was there a more intense experience of that on the Camino? Yes, I think there was. But there's something strange about having no story or being able to articulate our story to another person, who I love doing, by the way, that gives you the freedom to engage in, perhaps they're just temporary relationships too. Elsa, does that make sense to you?
I have a theory on that, which I believe quite strongly, which is that, you know, the Camino is a profound and beautiful experience. But for me, the real Camino is actually coming home and being in relationship with the people who are ongoing in your life. It's much harder. And I had a conversation with about that one day on the road with the amigo, who's a central character in the book, where he was saying it was hard. And I said, no, it's not as hard as real life. You know, and I do think that the beautiful, profound, hard Camino is the one that we walk with our daily relationships, you know, the ones that test us over time. That said, there's also a culture in Spain about pilgrimage, which is beautiful, which I encountered on that road where people didn't know I was a pilgrim. I've never forgotten one day a woman was sitting in a car not far from Santiago, maybe 100 kilometres short of Santiago, and she was watching because there were more pilgrims on the road at that point. And when I came level with her car, she jumped out and she said, "Will you make a prayer for me in Santiago?" And I said, "Yes, of course." Now, they would often say that of a pilgrim, "Will you make a prayer for me in Santiago?" And there's this sense of the pilgrim's road being somehow honourable and it means something to them. And I said, "What would you like me to say?" And she said her mother was dying and would I pray for her? And she wanted to give me some money. And I said, "No, no." She said, "Light a candle." I said, "No, no." And she said, "No, I must give you money." And I thought about my transaction at the beginning. Finally, I took €2 from her and she said, "I picked you." And I said, "Why?" She said, "I have waited for an hour for the right pilgrim." Now, I don't know what that means, but they have this deep, deep sense that pilgrims and pilgrimage mean something.
But it also drew something out in you. I recall an incident where you walk into a church and you see a woman crying by herself, and you reach over and you wipe her tears. And she pulls you close or holds your hand and you ask her why she's crying and it's for love. Mm. And there's a real strong moment where you give her comfort. I think you're both comforted in a sense by that.
She was so beautiful, that woman, and she was bereft. It was really terribly disturbing, but there was something. And having the pack on the back, you know, I have this real thing about that pack, being conscious of the burden that one carries in a really positive way. As I hugged her, I always remember that I had this feeling that I was going to fall into her, but that somehow it wouldn't have mattered because she was so welcoming of comfort. Mm. It was a really intense transaction, that one.
I want to ask you, Elsa, about how walking the Camino was a test of your own faith. It's interesting because one of the very first encounters you have is with a German gentleman who you call Herr
Theology
or Herr T.
Yes.
He appears in the book. And you had a very sharp exchange about his belief in God.
Yes, it was actually the very first day walking out of Granada, and at the end of the day, the only other pilgrim I met in that 400 kilometres. And he was a theologian who'd been trained by then Cardinal, now ex-Pope Ratzinger. And I did have a moment of thinking, great, I'm going to get all my answers now neatly tied up. but we challenged each other a lot. And he came to represent for me, I suppose, the version of the Catholic Church that had alienated me, actually. Very doctrinaire, very set in his ways. And in fact, I didn't really understand that conversations, they were not harsh, but it was me asking questions in much the way that I ask questions of Tony, but Tony's quite prepared to answer the question or grapple with it or to remind me of how things have changed.
At times.
At times, yes, at times.
We as both best
say
I through can.
Gritted teeth, we both say. But my theologian on the road, I realised when in Cordoba, of course, I realised that he was going through a much deeper crisis of faith than I was, and he broke down, actually. He had a terrible breakdown, and so I stayed with him until we met some other Germans on the road. And I think, had I not been carrying sins, I think I would not have stayed with him, actually. But I had this thing that I felt that if I was carrying the sins of others, I couldn't commit a sin myself, not knowingly. And it felt like to abandon him, much as I wanted to, would have been somehow sinful, so I stayed with him. And, you know, he was so fragile. He had all the armour of someone who has the answers. But it didn't help him in the end, as he wept in Cordoba.
She called him Herr Theology, in whom the Camino prompted some real soul-searching. Peregrinos, or pilgrims, Ailsa Piper and Father Tony Doherty have both separately walked the Camino de Santiago. And here's a traditional melody from Galicia, the Celtic region in northwest Spain, whose capital is Santiago de Compostela. The Irish band The Chieftains, who made their own pilgrimage, are joined by guitarist Elliot Fisk on Maneo. Walking the Camino, you never know who you'll encounter and what confidences you'll share. As Ailsa Piper discovered on her trek of the Mozarabe, the pilgrim trail from Granada to Salamanca and up to Santiago. Her account has been published as Sinning Across Spain. See the gallery of pictures from her trip on the Spirit of Things website here on RN Summer. I'm speaking with her and Father Tony Doherty. Well, you met another person along the way whom you called your amigo. Mm. And that prompted another kind of righteous rage in you when he confessed a secret that he'd been carrying about his brother.
Yeah. He was a lesson in so many ways, because I really did think I could walk alone after the theologian. That was what I wanted, was to be alone. And on the very first day as I walked out of Merida in this Act 2, there he was. Very attractive Spanish man who adored company and wanted me to be his company. So I was angry with him from the start, and then I wrestled with desire at one point about him, so that sin that I was carrying, the one I least expected to meet, came up. We became very, very good friends, but there was a day, I knew he was walking, early on he told me he was walking because of his brother who had suicided. So I did know that. He was walking for him, as many pilgrims do. But there was a day when he said that he wanted to tell me that his brother, who had suicided, had done it because he'd been abused by a man of the cloth as a young boy. I didn't have the Spanish to really understand that. So I kept asking him questions, and in the end he mimed it. I don't make too much of that moment in the book. It's there. But actually to watch an adult man miming the abuser's position and then to watch him miming the perspective of the child was, for me, you see, now whenever abuse comes up, I have that in my mind. It was profoundly upsetting, and I was furious, and I was carrying anger for many people, and I felt like I could have committed any number of murders in that moment about that child, grown a man who had children and then killed himself. And I've never forgotten my amigo saying to me, tranquilo, tranquilo, no te preocuparte. And, you know, don't worry, don't worry. And, you know, sort of comforting me. And I didn't understand that. But, of course, he'd been walking with that for many years. He was the only one in his family who knew the story. He remains the only one in his family to know the story. He feels he must carry the secret. So there were layers of it. You know, and I hear all the stuff that's going on now, and I think it's about secrets. Only when you bring this stuff into the light is there any hope of change. And, you know, by telling me, actually relieved something for himself in a way.
Father Tony, when you read that part of the book, how did it affect you?
Well, it was only 12 months ago, and perhaps the time is even darker now, but it was certainly dark times in the church, and dark times for those of us who minister as priests. But that was certainly the context and the thought and my emotional sort of rawness because of these very black days that made the story of Ailsa's amigo very sharply sort of relevant. Most of the feelings that I have are, confusion, anger, disgust, really struggling with the way that I'm part of an organisation where, and part of a sort of a brotherhood of priests, if you like, where some of these stories have been located. So reading the story continued to add to the fund of that unpleasantness. Well, that's too timid a word, isn't it?
I mean,
disgust. But I think it may have been the trigger to my interest in Ailsa's whole strategy and approach and experience to ask myself the question, to what extent do I carry the sins of others? The answer is yes. I mean, not in the transactions, in the particular way that the book is constructed, but I do feel, and I know some of the priests who have been subject to criminal action and some in prison, and the carrying of other people's delinquencies and brokenness is really made incredibly intense at a time like this. So I thought this carrying of one another's sins has a great deal of validity about it.
Is loss of faith a reasonable reaction to the child sexual abuse crisis?
I'd prefer to use the word confusion, but there are some positive sides about it, by the way. And the positive sides is you begin to think about what you're doing with a level of intensity and depth that perhaps was not previously available. I see that we are in a wounding church in trying to carry on this fragile ministry in a world which has gone through an enlightenment and is postmodern, and you're using language and ideas and rituals that fewer people sort of find satisfying. They're difficult waters to swim in. But in fact, the carrying of one another's sins and the broken nature of the church really has very strong scriptural background. Jesus was crucified. He said, "He is the way." We're living in a very crucifying time.
Mm.
Now, I don't want to focus upon our woundedness, because the real focus is on those people who have been damaged and irreparably sometime. Mm. So our focus needs to be there. But my understanding of being a church and a minister, I think, may have been, if I can put some sort of a positive spin on it, deepened by this tragic crisis that we're going through at the moment.
Ailsa, you wrote, "Sins ignored can be ugly. Sins addressed can have such beauty." How did you mean that? And can it be applied to a situation as dire as the one your amigo described?
I think it can. For me, the thing about sins ignored being ugly is I don't think there's a escaping things. I think we can bury stuff, we can pretend they don't happen, but I think all our actions have consequences, and I think the consequences have cost, if not for us, for someone else. I mean, I really do believe that. I wasn't head girl for nothing. but, you know, I think that's how I view life, that everything's going to flow to something else. And there's great beauty for me, as there was right from the beginning, in the people who addressed their sins open-eyed to me, and along the road as I tried to be open-eyed with other people. And in that moment for my amigo of shifting from someone who had a buried sin, a hidden sin that he carried, and he did say to me at one point, "Is this my sin?" And I remember saying, no es tu pecado. Pecado is the word for sin. And, you know, I said it practically every day in Spain. But that thing of it's not your sin. And, of course, I don't have the right to judge what's a sin. But I feel like there's something in that transaction of saying, I'll tell you exactly who I am, really all of who I am and what I carry, that is intensely beautiful no matter what the sin. Now, recently in a conversation with Tony, when I said I don't know that I could carry the abuse sin, I am so angry about it. And, you know, it is an area in which I just think you harm a child. I question the humanity of it. But I also recognise it's entrenched in many cultures, child brides, you know. I mean, but Tony said a great thing to me, which was it brought me up sharp. He said, well, I know people who are in prison and who might seek some kind of support from me, some kind of assistance, some kind of solace. What would you have me do? Ignore them or engage with them? And of course, I can't say, well, say no, don't offer help. I can't actually say that because that goes counter to what I believe. So, I mean, I have to believe that somehow by bringing this stuff into the light, by attempting to carry what we can of others, or at least to listen, that something beautiful emerges. You know, and I think that it's our scars that are the beautiful bits of our body. I have many scars from walking. And when recently I was leading a workshop and I wanted to demonstrate something to someone, I didn't go to my best bit, my bit that I like best, which happens to be my feet. I went to the scars that I carry, you know, because they tell the stories. And there's something for me profoundly beautiful about the scars when we can own them and when we can truly show them, I suppose, without asking someone to ignore that broken bit of us.
Could I just say something there, Rachel, too? To focus upon scars, I think, is actually a very practical, concrete way of looking at your own life. I have a slightly different language to it. I believe we all carry distress. We're broken. Now, some of that brokenness is deliberate, and you might refer to sin to describe that. A lot of it's indeliberate, neurosis, illness, a whole range of factors in this extraordinary genius, which is the human body, the human person. But we all carry distress. To discharge that distress is a very important part of our going forward, our healing, our developing. We discharge our distress when people pay attention to us. And I think within those words, I make sense of the genius of Ailsa's work.
She has on paper, genius? He said genius?
I've gone over the top. Clearly, I've said too much here. But it's paying attention to a person, hearing them, that is the real moment of release and growth and absolution.
I think you're so right, and it's partly what sets your book apart, Ailsa, and that is that walking the Camino was not just an extraordinarily gorgeous, wonderful experience of looking at the scenery and just having, you know, fantastic epiphanies, but it was so much about the interaction that you had with people that went right down into the most painful and sensitive parts of you.
I do think people have a yearning to be known, to be seen. I mean, I think people want to be seen.
We ache for it. Yeah,
and I think that's the thing. If you can pay attention, people will tell stories. And I mean, since the book, that's the other interesting thing. The stories continue, the confessions continue. People tell me extraordinary things, which I'm so privileged to hear. Some days they're hard. But I think that yearning to be fully known exists with all of us. But of course, we live in a world where we only want the Facebook, you know, airbrushed version of ourselves to be out there.
Oh, that's a very pertinent comment indeed. Now, this is also about your faith. Throughout the time that you were on the road, on the pilgrimage, and that was it 40 days? 42
days. I wanted it to be 40 days and 40 nights, but it wasn't.
Darn.
You're a born theologian, Ailsa.
You are, indeed. 40 days and 40 nights. It did Moses a lot of good, and Jesus. Why not Ailsa Piper? She's the author of Sinning Across Spain, which is a really moving account, sorry about the pun, that prompts some poetic reflections from Ailsa as she reflects on what her faith is really made of. The Spirit of Things is taking you down the Pilgrim Road here on RN Summer. You were grappling with what your faith is made up of and what's the meaning, really, of being here. What have been the main ingredients in shaping your faith?
Well, I was raised a Catholic, but a kind of unusual Catholic, because my parents divorced back in the early 60s when I was quite small. And I had a very bolshy mother who was pretty angry at the way the church dealt with divorcees then. And so her tactic was to send me to a Catholic school, but to say, I'm not going to church on Sundays, but you guys can absolutely go and I will take you and I will pick you up. Whatever works for you, I will support, you know, First Communion, confirmation, all of those things, all the rituals. From very early on, I was forced to answer the question, what works for you? Not, you'll be doing this. So I observed, perhaps from a slightly different viewpoint back then, and also, of course, to be the child of a divorce was very unusual back in the early 60s. I also grew up in the outback of Western Australia, and that was my whole family tradition. And my grandmother actually spoke Yamaji, which was the local language, and my mother, when she was dying, she was quite young when she died, she couldn't peacefully die until she had reconnected with a Yamaji woman called Pearl, who found her, mysteriously came to her bedside.
So do you have Aboriginal blood in you, or
I don't,
was it
well,
by association?
No, I don't think I do. I'm sure I don't, actually. It was just that my family, generations of them, had grown up in what's called the Gascoyne of Western Australia, red earth, sheep station country. In fact, they say of my grandmother, and I can hear it in the one little tape I have, that her accent was a mixture of Irish and Yamaji, which is kind of wonderful. It's so odd. Because it was so remote, and they were that was who they played with. They were the families that they lived with. So, but my mother's only spirituality that meant anything to her really was borrowed from the Aboriginal people she'd been taught by and grown up with. So when she was dying, she believed she was being sung to death. That's what the cancer was. So I was there with her, but she couldn't go until Pearl had come to her bedside.
Now, does that have something to do with your own penchant for singing along the Camino?
I don't know. I do think that I learned to walk in that red desert area when I was very small, and there are stories told of me as a very small child, really very small, just wandering off into the Spinifex and causing mayhem. But my mother says I never ever felt lost, that I always felt like I could just keep walking. And I feel that very intensely now, that, you know, that walking will, that the planet will look after me. Now that sounds naive and a bit airy-fairy, but it is actually my experience.
But it does take me to your reflection on prayer, which appears on page 240. In Sinning Across Spain, and yes. I'd love you to read it, because okay. It does evoke some of that wonderful affinity for natural surroundings.
It's quite beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, I felt like it's where I finally found a place that felt like belief, because I envied it. I envy faith terribly, or that particular faith, but I found mine. Anyway, this is direct from the journal, so it's not edited or anything. For me, prayer is walking. Every step is a prayer. And if there are sacred places, then the ones I have seen are roads that stretch to the horizon, empty of all save perhaps a fellow traveller, dotted in the distance, walking a separate but connected way. A saint is a tree beside a road, the branches wide enough to give comfort and solace in equal measure. A sermon is a story told at sunset, two spirits meeting to pay attention, to listen, and to learn. Divinity is the moment when heartbeats and footsteps align, find each other, and mark miles together. Miracles ask little and give much. Like a woman tucking homemade food into a stranger's pockets, miracles quicken the step, light the way in the early morning dark, and are the first star of the evening cool. Miracles are journeys from emptiness to fullness, from heartbreak to heartache to heartburn to heart's ease, and back again. And heaven is a place where good people do bad things and bad people do good things, and somewhere out on the miraculous road, good and bad people look into each other's eyes and realize there is no separation. They are the same. And Buen Camino is a blessing. Good road, good path, good way. Perhaps it is the only blessing.
Father Tony, You are a Catholic priest from a great historic scholastic theological tradition. Do you think that Catholicism gets heavy competition from the kind of spirituality that Ailsa describes in this prayer?
It's very beautiful, isn't it? Do I see it as competition? Not really.
A saint is a tree in this prayer.
Yes, that's fairly challenging, isn't it? Could I approach it a little bit obliquely? Let me say something very surprising. I think one of the great illusions that we live in this broad Western civilization of ours, the great religions, the illusion is that we can talk about God in simple terms. To actually use the word God is uncommonly difficult. In fact, it's dangerous, particularly if we speak in such quick tones as we normally do. So we're looking for, I think, any search for faith or belief. There's a teacher of mine who said, look, let's put the word God aside for a moment and use the word gracious mystery. We live in this gracious mystery. This planet, this universe of ours, can be described as a mystery, but it's gracious. It is a loving, accepting. In a sense, and perhaps I'm stretching it, aren't I, that Ailsa is attending to that gracious mystery in words which are, yes, they don't fit into the Nicene Creed easily, but they make sense to me, and I think they might make sense to lots of other people too. And that has always been the task of theology. It is faith seeking understanding, faith looking for a language that makes sense to the human experience that we're going through. And the human experience now is different to what it was perhaps 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago. And we need a new language, a new understanding. And I'd like to see that Ailsa's, that's not the final attempt, is it? It's the attempt of a person to go back to a word which is very valuable to me, paying attention to the gracious mystery in which we're living, which is populated by both people of all types, that lovely sense of good people doing bad things and bad people doing good. That's the reality. That's the reality of our broken humanity.
And looking into each other's eyes and finding there's no separation, Ailsa.
Which is the connecting question that the book continues to raise with us.
Ailsa, you said that, or you actually read somewhere along the way, that you don't walk the Camino walks you. Mm. So do you think that the Camino had a plan for you that you weren't truly expecting?
Well, I do, I suppose. I walked that first Camino on the Camino Francés, and that felt miraculous in another way. It was my road. You know, I had my experience, my lovely Camino. It was quite profound, actually. I shouldn't make light of it. I never expected to come back, and I certainly didn't expect the whole sin engagement. And every single time I thought I had anything worked out, it would undo me in the most miraculously apt way. For someone who loves to use rituals when I teach, it would devise rituals for me. It would rip me open. And, you know, I remember one day being literally, you know, bare-rumped because I couldn't get across a river and I had to strip off and carry things across, and standing on the other side of it, alone in the middle of this field, and shouting at the skies, you know, that's it, I'm really shouting, giving it what for. And feeling the road as a real presence, you know, that the road was doing things to me. And on one day, being on all fours with my pack on my back, heaving what felt like something from very deep inside, trying to get rid of it. But it felt to me like that road is sacred. And the reason I think it's sacred is that those roads have been walked for thousands and thousands of years by people hoping and questing to find meaning.
Well, when you got to Santiago, you went a further 100 kilometres. And that was, I think, 3 years ago now, for the final ritual.
Yes, it was. It was almost to the day, 3 years. Finisterre is where the pagan Camino ended. It means Land's End. That was where the scallop shell tradition came from, that pilgrims would walk out there and they'd find scallop shells on the beach. And that's become, over time, the symbol of the pilgrim. And I walked out there really because when I got to Santiago, I sat in the cathedral with my list of sins and thought, I don't know what this is about. It, you know, there's been no lightning strike. They're not done. So I thought, I'll keep walking. And I made a little fire on the rocks as the sun set, quite late at night because it was summer. And I burned the list and I burned every bit of it. And there was just one word left on the piece of paper. And it was for, F-O-R. And I remember thinking, well, that's not a very good word. And I thought about it and I thought, for what? And it was for love and for hope and for forgiveness and for all these, what had I walked for, you know? And it was so beautiful, that tiny scrap of paper. And then a man said, as the sun set, oh, the sun's rising on the other side of the world, maybe in Australia. And I piped up and said, I'm from Australia. And he said, well, then it's rising on your home. I can't tell you why the word home affected me so much at that particular moment, but it just felt like I had landed and the sins had left me in the fire. And, you know, those rituals, I learned to make ritual as a little girl, probably in the church, but I'm intent on making my own rituals now. I think that the rituals that really shift us are the ones that we earn for ourselves.
Well, speaking of shift, I know you wanted to shift the burden of pride, but I think, Ailsa Piper, you should be very, very proud of this book, Sinning Across Spain, and the sort of work that it can do in our hearts and minds. I thank you so much for being on The Spirit of Things, Ailsa Piper and Father Tony Doherty.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you. What have I learned in 1,200 kilometres? Well, I do have faith. In the simplicity of walking, the power of forgiveness, the kindness of Spaniards, the goodness that wants to prevail, the ache to be better, and the impulse to serve. I believe in the restful set of evening and the pale, wispy promise of morning, in the hope of rain on parched soil. I believe in confession with all my heart, telling the true story of ourselves, eye to eye with another human being, owning up to all that we are. I believe that stories shape our lives and that the more honest we are in our stories, the more freedom we will gain. I know there's nothing more sacred to me than the act of putting one foot down on a dusty road and then putting down the other, again and again for as long as it takes, turning up and doing the work. And I know that the work never ends. I know there is beauty in effort. I know slow is sublime. Slow food, slow dance, slow talk. I know snails are gurus. I know we are all connected whether we like it or not, and we owe it to this astonishing planet and those we hope might come after to acknowledge that fact in our actions as well as our words. I don't know any more than I ever did about what comes after, or if there even is an after. But one thing I do know, I absolutely know, I will die, and I'm perfectly happy to die wondering. There are so many wonders.
From the book by Ailsa Piper, Sinning Across Spain, A Walker's Journey from Granada to Galicia, I guarantee it'll have you eyeing off your walking shoes and wondering, could you do it? Ailsa was a guest of the Sydney Writers Festival. See some of her pictures on the Spirit of Things website. And while you're there, download the audio to your mobile and check out some of the other offerings on RN Summer. Next week, the woman whose whole life is like a bodhisattva tale, and yet she calls herself a bad Buddhist. Compared to her brother, the Dalai Lama, I guess she's always felt a bit puny. But Jetsun Pema has given thousands of Tibetan children an education and a chance at a good life. I'm Rachel Kahn. Meet her next week on The Spirit of Things, here on RN Summer.